I'm Matt Gerasimovich, PhD candidate at Northwestern University, studying Russian literature and film.
And I'm Cameron Lalana, a literature enthusiast and guy working in media. We're two friends who met studying in Russia. We like talking about books so much that we made it into a podcast.
And this is the podcast for people who want to learn more about Slavic literature, art, and culture. Every episode, we're going to bring you the background and analysis you'll need to know to understand these works.
If you're interested in supporting us, you can head on over to our website, slaviclitpod.com. All right, Matt, we're continuing on with the Gross Man train. Which chapters are we covering this week?
This week, we are doing chapters 21 through 50 of Life and Fate. This is our fourth, probably, episode, long episode, but we've done about a million short episodes every chapter to date. If you want to really go granular and do it that way, too.
Yeah, so this will be a good chance for those of you who've not been following along with those to get a broad overview of what we've been covering in those. And if you have been listening to them, there's probably going to be a few thoughts that we had in those episodes that we are bringing here and either didn't have time for or just forgot to mention in those. So there's something for everybody.
Speak for yourself. Everything I'm bringing today is novel.
All right. Well, shit, I shouldn't have written down only points that I've already made in my little document of reusable points.
All yeah, right,
that's
yeah,
fine. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I'll make them up as we go. Fuck it, right. We'll do it live.
Yeah, yeah, good.
Good. All right, well, as per usual, we will not be covering a granular study of what actually happened because that's been covered in the dailies, so check those out if you would like to follow along with those. But for a broad overview of events, we're going to be covering the front, broadly speaking, Stalingrad, which contains a kind of a frenetic several chapters with Burozkin getting sick, getting bombed, Klimov leaving House 6-1 in order to go find Seryozha, having a meeting with the German, coming back to find that House 6-1 and Grekov and all the other men that we've been reading about so far are dead. We've been reading about Victor and Ludmilla returning to Moscow to a little bit more dissociation for Ludmilla for the most part, and then Victor having some issues in his professional life. Issues in his personal life, too, but he doesn't care about those so much.
Just having issues.
They're just having issues. That's a good summary of the war. People are just having issues.
Well, Victor specifically.
Right. Well, everyone else's issues are, of course, lesser than his. So after that, we go to our SS officer, Liss, who is overseeing the construction of a death camp, unclear which one. We follow along with his process of going from factory to factory to make sure all these parts are still being done correctly before finally meeting with Eichmann, which is an interesting meeting. Eichmann being a person that Liss personally does not find all that interesting or even seem to understand all that well. From there, we turn to the front again, where the Soviets are mustering their forces in order to counterattack the German army, which has taken almost the entirety of Stalingrad. Through that part, we focus mostly on Novikov's tank corps and the issues he deals with, like, hey, the Air Force keeps accidentally bombing us, could you stop? And High Command being like, all right, who are you trying to pin the blame on this for? From there, we kind of come into the end section where we return to Klimov, who is now recovering after being shot. Well, after being grazed in the head, after being blown in the head, as Matt nicely put it for us. Yeah. who is recovering and spends that time going to a rather disappointing Obko meeting and then meeting with his ex-wife's brother-in-law, Spiridonov, who is the head of Stalgrez, of the power factory that's still functioning there, before finally turning to an extended scene in, I think, Auschwitz, one of the death camps, as we follow along with some of the guards, some of the prisoner workers, and finally a very difficult sequence of scenes as Sophia Leventon and David go to the gas chamber. All right, so nice heavy episode, but that's all of them. But hey, that's why you're here. If you've been around for this long, you know what you're in for.
Yeah, I think that this part, because we're kind of in the real meat of the book, we're getting towards the end, reading downhill, as I say, after I get halfway through a book.
Right.
Right. It is the real culmination of a lot of the tension that has been building in a lot of parts of the book. And one of the kind of harrowing things, I think, that we understand that this is happening, having, you know, reading this from our time now, of how many people, knowing how many people approximately died in the Holocaust. But you kind of, with our sort of main cast of characters, there might be this idea that maybe Grossman or the author is sort of setting us up to have some dramatic finale, Soviet forces rushing, you know, to save the day. And that's just not the kind of book that this is, if you haven't quite picked up on it yet. So I think that that's kind of, it's part of what makes this book interesting, is the heroism is kind of not exactly where you expect it.
Right. To the extent that heroism really exists, which there is perilous and little of. In fact, I think it's interesting that for a lot of this book, this is maybe especially true in this part, or this is just maybe more outsized because after Grekov's death, this is something that Krimov begins to think more about, but of the unique freedoms that the war also brings, right? I would say sort of the biggest heroes in the book up to this point are sort of the soldiers of House 6/1. You know, of course, the term hero has been thrown around quite often, especially in regard to everyone in Stalingrad, but we have in the previous, I believe it was the previous part of the episode before that, we have an entire chapter sitting with Spiridonov and Vera and the others who are called heroes, who are really uncomfortable with that, frankly, because they are just, they're just surviving, really, and they just can't think of anything better to do than to keep doing their jobs. Not to say that that is not heroic in its own way, but right, like that's, I mean, they would cut and run if they could, but they simply can't. They're just so exhausted in trying to live, and we have that being thrown around for people like them, but then we come to House 6/1 where they kind of are taking on this heroic role. Not that they ever think about it. Not that anyone ever really calls them heroes. In fact, mm-hmm. they're kind of persecuted for their success a little bit because they aren't doing it in the appropriate Soviet way, which would require a lot more inflexibility. Let's say, in holding back the German forces, which after they're wiped out, I think this is something that Krimov begins to think more and more of, as he feels, similar to Mostovskoy, feels more and more alienated from his fellow party apparatchiks, and more kind of obsessed with Grekov throughout this part.
Yeah, this idea of freedom too, it's so kind of amorphous and difficult to pin down. I think that's kind of the point, and I think we can sort of go in order through the chapters, the major sequences of this part here, but I did want to start just briefly actually at the end on chapter 49, which was one of my favorites so far, and it is where Grossman kind of discusses this, life versus death, and freedom versus, you know, denial of freedom, and he ends on this really interesting thought. He says that what constitutes the freedom, the soul of an individual life, is its uniqueness. The reflection of the universe in someone's consciousness is the foundation of his or her power. But life only becomes happiness, is only endowed with freedom and meaning, when someone exists as a whole world that has never been repeated in all eternity. Only then can they experience the joy of freedom and kindness, finding in others what they have already found in themselves. And this was such a wonderful way to put the culmination of the book and the kind of essence of what everyone is fighting for. And I think that for him, despite, for Grossman, despite all of the terrible and tragic and horrific things that he's seen, the fact that this sense of freedom can still exist, as we've been saying, it's still worth fighting for. And that's the sort of bleak optimism that exists throughout this book. And also, I did have my a few parts ago, my Grossman GPT comment.
Right.
And I do think this is kind of like Grossman GPT 2.0, I would say, in some ways. And if you'll bear with me, I think it's somewhat relevant to a lot of the debates that we're having on like AI and just generative language models and generative everything, this and that. And as we've discussed, right, it's not really creating anything new. It's just creating a sort of pastiche of things that already exist, just kind of rearranged. And I think that that's what is kind of, it's not necessarily like inherently dangerous per se, but it does miss something. And for all the hysteria over it kind of taking over our lives and everything, I just don't buy it because of this. This is a really profound way of understanding what it means to be human and unique and to be alive and to have freedom. And it's something that I think a lot of our kind of current corporate big business tech mindset has a really difficult time reconciling with. And for that reason, I say SlavicLitPod.com, if you are a large corporation that has too much money and can't spend it all, we will come tell you what it means to be free and to live, and we will consult for your business.
Yeah, we're more than prepared to take the entirety of the themes of life and fate and then just go ahead and grind it through the meat grinder of Generation P and turn it into ad copy for you.
There's nothing Grossman would have loved more than for us to talk about his book to a tech company.
Yeah, I think that this whole section about the uniqueness of the individual soul would really work well with a marketing department looking for a new way to say, hey, you're a product, believe in yourself, buy our stuff because you're worth it.
Because you're worth it. Yeah.
Because your individual joy and freedom deserves our product.
That's right. I know, it is interesting on an unrelated note to think about basically how a lot of that same logic and that same way of thinking does get refracted through just an overwhelmingly dominant market focused mentality. But that's sort of a little unrelated to the book.
Yeah, a little unrelated, but a little funny how deeply I don't think people realize Soviet techniques, not like developed by the Soviets as propaganda, but just developed in the Soviet Union, are still heavily in use in media around the world, but especially in advertising.
Don't you take my dissertation topic. Don't you scoop me here.
Right, I'll just bleep that out just so people don't realize. Yeah. we don't want that one to get out.
Yeah, so everyone's gonna be like, why is there a 30-second, 30 seconds of no sound in your episode?
All right, well, let's take it from the top. Let's start with at the front of Stalingrad. I presume probably let's start with, rather than Burozkin, although it's a very touching chapter when a letter from his wife revives him, I think maybe the more interesting part is when Klimov meets a German on the battlefield.
Yes, that is a good spot to start. And I do just want to say that I think it's worth keeping that idea and that quote from chapter 49 in mind as we go through the rest of these chapters, just because I think it touches on every part of the book. It's really the kind of core essence of what it means to read this book, I think. And this chapter gets to that on why fight wars, basically, and what it means to really see someone as a person and not just an enemy combatant. And that's what this chapter is kind of getting to, where Klimov is stuck in an artillery crater, basically, with he thinks it's with someone else from his division, but it's not. It ends up being a German, and they're like basically, because they're under such heavy artillery fire, I mean, they're just holding on for dear life, basically hoping that they don't get killed. And this really has a profound impact on Klimov as he gets up and he sees that he's been actually huddled next to a German soldier instead of the person he thought he was. And he goes through this, or the narrator, I guess, goes through this sort of checklist on everything that he knows how to do. And he knows that he's unshakably confident that he can pull a trigger, throw a grenade, strike a blow with a knife or a rifle, but a second earlier than his opponent. So he has no doubt in his ability to actually do the physical part of killing someone or of fighting someone. But here he falters. They both do. And they talk about that sort of automatic reflex that they possess, the instinct to kill failed to function. And this is a sort of, it's a breakdown in the ideological systems that have trained them both. See enemy, kill enemy. There's nothing in between. There's no humanity. There's no nothing. But this experience that they've been through together, it sort of reorients them, and it sort of almost defamiliarizes the concept of Russian, German, human, basically. It has nothing to do with nationality or anything here. It just has to do with the fact that they are humans.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought up that line about freedom from chapter 49, because I think it also...
You're welcome.
thank you, kun sir. I'm ever in your what's the word? I'm ever in your debt. Because it also reveals another through line of the idea of freedom in this book, because it's such a nebulous concept, and Grossman never really defines it, not that he ever needs to, because it's not about a strict definition, but rather it's, you know, about sort of about the vibe, right? It's about the vibe of being human.
Yeah, like you recognize it when you are in certain situations.
Yeah. Right?
It's not something that is just... He wants to get away from a theoretical explanation of a lot of things and into a sort of experiential mode, I think, of understanding the world.
Yeah, saying experiential mode of understanding the world is a nicer way of saying the vibes of it, I guess. If you want to bring your PhD training into it.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, but we're so used to, I think, at least for probably not that all of our listeners are Americans, but we might generally understand the idea of freedom as something that is a right that is granted upon us by our government, right? Like the idea that we are a free people, and therefore our government needs to protect that against whoever is our enemy that week, right? They're the enemies of freedom. And if you're deep in philosophy, you might understand there's other ways to also look at this, right? If you could also understand freedom as the natural state of mankind, and the state is stepping in to limit that freedom in order to make sure that everyone can more fully assert that, because, you know, yada, yada, yada. You could get into a lot of philosophical debates, but I think...
No step on snake.
No.
That's what I always say.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, so when I think generally it's understood in this, political context, right, as a right that can be granted, or as something that the state should or should not limit, whatever. But here we have this rather humanist understanding of freedom, where freedom is like the inherent state of the person, and not as I think Hobbes would understand it, not where freedom is the fact that in the state of nature that like every human wants to be a pleasure maximizer, right? And therefore, they're all going to be fighting each other to try to maximize their own pleasures. We're understanding freedom in this context rather as the ability to just exist as oneself and the kind of sublime beauty of being able to be oneself, right? I mean, talking about life as freedom and death as a sort of slavery, I think that's an inversion of how, I mean, I would typically think of that. You're like, thinking like, oh, thank God I die. I'm free. I don't have to pay taxes anymore. I don't have to I don't have to commute anymore. But it's then, as Grossman rightly points out, that eternally limits the ability of this soul to express itself in whatever way it chooses. So not that it's like not political, but it's like, it's parallel to the political question. And this freedom exists in this case within the state, right? And so you have the power of the state, which then represses the people. And I think specifically Grossman's writing about, you know, totalitarian governance. I don't think I don't know if Grossman say all states are doing this to you, but I think you could draw out the line that there's an eternal tendency by every state, by the mere fact of bureaucratization, by the fact that it just keeps doing what it does and just kind of wants to do more over time, and it has this tendency to, okay, well, we need to protect ourselves, which is kind of inherently a sort of reactionary force, always a little oppressive. This is the libertarian episode, I guess. I didn't realize that.
I was gonna say, yeah, going to say, yeah, you're making him sound like he voted for Gary Johnson.
But, you know, in this chapter, not my intention to go again, but, you know, this is how the argumentation is developing. I don't control it. I'm just the lightning rod for it. and when we came to this chapter, I think I understood there's this quote later in the chapter where it's as Klimov and the German look each other in the eyes, the narrator says, Life was terrible. It was as though they could understand, as though they could read in one another's eyes, that the power that had ground them into the mud would continue even after the war to oppress both conquered and conquerors. And at that point, I think I argued that it was like violence or war or something, or like the atomic bomb. And then you disagreed and kind of pointed out that you thought it was more the state. And at this point, I'm coming around to your way of thinking.
And
that
you've come back to the eternal conclusion.
It's always the state's fault.
Always the state's fault. Yeah. Always,
but right,
stop
like
the, paying taxes, become a sovereign citizen.
That's the message of this episode, I guess. So we have like right these two; they understand each other, and like the inherent freedom of their souls kind of connects in this moment that they both understand. They both realize that oh, like who we are as people is being ground into the mud by the totalizing force of our states, and that is of anything, right? This is what's the only thing that's mentioned, the only real moment of like suggested connection that the narrator gives to us. And so I guess we're kind of forced to assume that this is the most important thing to understand here, and we are hereby understanding freedom as this inherently free human thing which connects all peoples despite their circumstances. It's not delineated one people to another. It's not granted to a specific people and taken away from others. It is the eternal state of human beings, which is always a little bit being oppressed by like the power structures they exist in.
Yeah, it's a this was a really solid chapter, I thought. I didn't want to spend, you know, too much time on any individual chapter, I guess, but I did like this one quite a lot out of this whole section. I think that it is a really good illustration of some of the more theoretical things that Grossman is getting at, and I think it's so relevant to nowadays as well, just when it comes to dehumanizing other people during wartime, especially. That's one of the things that this book, it's written like late enough in an era that's late enough to still be directly applicable to nowadays. There's some things that we like, or I will take out of its original context and try to apply the underlying idea of it, right? Like all of my AI quips, but this is like, there's no debate. This is what happens. I mean, you can look at pretty much any conflict, and if you ask how you get to the level of genocide, it is described in this book very clearly.
Right. Yeah, which is applicable, and although a book with the Holocaust applicable to every case, not even frankly going beyond genocide, just any case of mass murder in the initial step of dehumanization, which is something that when he, as you say, is directly relevant to today, you know, directly relevant to today, directly relevant to every military conflict. It's a prerequisite of a successful military that they can train that essential need to see another human being as human out of them to make them successful fighters. So there's just eternally, as long as there's the need, maybe that's a strong, as eternally as there is an opportunity or a reason to fight a war, good or bad, that tendency will also exist, and this will be maintained relevancy.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Most of it is broken down to opportunity, not need. So that's super cool.
So that's our stance in warfare, I guess.
War is bad.
War is bad. That's we've really cracked the code on this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did. Good on us.
So from there, let's want to move forward to talking about House 6/1.
Yeah, I did. And even though this is a very short bit here, I just wanted to kind of talk about how they die, basically, and the fact that they get essentially an off-screen death in this. Like, the death is reported from one person to another, just that the house was wiped out. So I think it's an interesting approach to kind of writing warfare and in this book as a whole, just kind of writing this time period, where I think that Grossman, by structuring their end this way and structuring the book there's multiple major characters that are wiped out in this one sentence. And I think that that is, it is an attempt to illustrate how quickly and how radically the kind of landscape of life can be altered by war. And these people that were, that had, you know, it's not like they're our family members, but we've gotten to know them. We've gotten close with some of them as readers, and to just have that completely exterminated by one line is really difficult to reconcile with, and to continue reading on again, knowing that there is that loss that has happened and will continue to be felt throughout the narrative. And it'll be interesting to sort of compare this idea with how then Grossman describes the episode of Sophia and David going to the gas chambers, which is of course a multi-chapter situation, and it builds differently and it does something different. But the fact that both of these actually happen in this chunk is a good comparative study, I think.
Yeah. Also, Mostovskoy's death too, as you're saying that, it kind of makes me think that we have an inversion of traditional war stories here a little bit, right? We have for House 6/1 and for Mostovskoy involved in this underground resistance to the Germans. In another book, that might be the pivotal moment or the climax of the novel. Their attempts to carry out one final meaningful act before they're wiped out, right? You've got the sort of the heroism of war, right? But that's not the case here. There is no heroism. There's just success or there's death. And because we aren't following their perspective, you don't hear other people's deaths in terms of their heroic last stands. You get the report that that battalion was wiped out. Maybe best case scenario, there are some survivors you'll find at some point in the future. Truer to life, I think, an understanding of all these things, of House 6/1, of finding out about Mostovskoy's attempted rebellion, presumably ending quickly, you know, on an interrogation floor. It's tough. It's rejecting sort of the heroism a lot of other stories might imbue in these things. It's not heroic. It just happened. And then inversely, we have, we'll get to it more later, but what the gas chamber scene, there's such a tendency to dehumanize those moments. And I think that's not intentional. I think a lot of media wants to show how dehumanizing it is. But by doing that, it also literally necessarily dehumanizes the people involved, which is something that Grossman resists the urge to do, to kind of rage against and say, no, these were people. I want to convey the horror. I want to convey that, but not at the cost of letting you forget that, you know, the individual value of everyone in this room. And so you have these two opposite depictions of how a lot of media will go about these particular types of events.
Yeah, it's he's very Tolstoyan in the sense that you very rarely get acts of individual heroism in war. Most of what happens in war is like sort of this coincidence or incidental things that happen. Just pure chance. It's just kind of almost pure chance that this house is finally wiped off the map. It's not that there was no real, as we see or as we hear, I guess, there's no, like you said, there's no final stand. There's no, I don't know. There's no, it lacks what you would expect based on what they've been building up to. And then the fact that a lot of them are going to be denied military honors because of Krimov's report is it just a little more salt in the wound.
Right. good
chance. Yeah, and it just goes to show, like, I don't know if this is what Grossman's getting at 100%, but so much of our understanding of war and the people that are in it is really just constructed. We don't often get insight in the way that you get in a novel, right? Because how could you? Because there's not usually not always reporters there. I mean, it's a little bit different nowadays, I guess. But at this time, for sure, what was going on in the battlefield ends up largely being a constructed version of what ends up being useful. And if these are not good ideological soldiers, then they're not getting their they are not getting their military honors if they're not everything is falling in line in terms of service to the state. So
yeah, I think this is something we can talk more about when we're towards the end of the novel, but I think there's something to be an interesting conversation to be had on how warfare is portrayed, because I think you're essentially correct that almost unless you've actually, you know, been in the military, been in a combat situation, frankly, even then, almost all of our understanding of every war or every other war, if you happen to fight in one, is going to be constructed through media. How much of that media is written by someone who's actually there versus how much was written by someone later on? You know, take in point, going back to the last part where Krimov argues with a commander who believes fully that Tolstoy had to have been in the patriotic war against Napoleon because he writes so truly about it and doesn't believe Krimov telling him the truth, which is that Tolstoy is writing that, you know, 40, 50 years onward from the war.
This is a real challenge for me, actually, because I think that there's some truth in what is being discussed on this, just on a larger level, because it's sort of like, I think I've used this term before, but it's sort of like a spiritual truth in some ways. When you're reading something and it may not have happened exactly as described, but there is something that is still striking as true to experience, true to form, it just, there's something about it. And it's almost a balancing act when you're doing this, because I would say that Grossman's novel has some of this in it as well. And of course, the things that are being discussed, right, a lot of them happened, but they didn't happen as depicted. It's not, you wouldn't pick this up as a historical document, as a list of events that truly transpired as such. It's fiction still at the end of the day. But there is some truth under that fiction. And I think that the like war construction of how war works and how it's often memorialized, it tries to capture some of that. But as we see in this case with House 6-1 and the reports and Grekov, you know, oh, he's a traitor, he shot me, and, you know, all this stuff, right? It's there's still an element of falsity there. And so there's a balancing act between how war can be remembered, what actually happened, and this sort of whether it has this air of truth or not to it. And it's difficult to exactly parse how it works, but it's something that I've been kind of noticing going on through the novel. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's that's... No, I follow it. It's a topic I find really interesting. I like to read a lot of a soldier's memoirs. That's a very unappealing hobby.
Yeah, just tell on yourself right there, Cameron.
No, soldier's memoirs are so interesting in the range from the purely factual to like the, you know, I could give you a whole list of really interesting ones. But one of the ones that strike me the most interesting is Tim O'Brien, who I think I've talked about before, whose entire writing career has frankly never really gotten over the Vietnam War, which, you know, you could lay as a criticism. I don't personally. I think if you got something to say, you know, say it. But
Cameron's also still not over the Vietnam War.
I think there are people in my life who look at me with suspicion as if I'm like ready to join the NVA, and I don't really understand why that specific suspicion jumps up in them. But I can tell you that there are people in my life who do think that about me. Tim O'Brien does this interesting thing where he writes two memoirs of his time as a soldier in Vietnam. The first one is If I Die in a Combat Zone, Box Me Up and Ship Me Home. And the second one is The Things They Carried. You might recognize The Things They Carried because it's something that a lot of American teenagers are forced to read the first chapter of. But interestingly, the first novel is a relatively straightforward memoir. The second one, as he admits, is completely fictional, almost completely fictional. And he really gets at the core of what, like, if you've already written a memoir, why write a fictional second memoir about the same event in this chapter called How to Tell a War Story or How to Tell a True War Story, where he talks about this one event of being in the jungle and one guy like being at the end of his wits and like shooting, fighting a water buffalo and killing it, and, well, trying to kill it. Like they keep shooting it and just won't die. And he talks, towards the end, he talks about telling that story, and this woman comes up and starts asking, like, it's so horrible what he did to the water buffalo. And then he reflects as, like, yo, like, no, you, like, that's not what it's about. You don't get it. And then he admits, so this story isn't true. Well, it's based on a kernel of truth, but every time I tell it, people like that woman would come up and tell me, oh, I feel so sick about this element. And every time he thought, no, that's not the point. And so he keeps changing it and keeps changing it until people finally get it. And then that kind of reveals the whole trick of this book, which is that it's almost entirely fictional, based on one kernel of truth in each chapter, but changed to the point where people cannot help but understand what he's trying to say. And I think that is something that most good authors of war are going to be doing, that they understand that the more important thing than the actual factual literal truth is what they're trying to make you understand about that. I think that is just as true here in this novel.
Yeah, I think that it is something that we often level as a critique, that it's not true, it's not factual. And I think actually in some ways it ends up being a strength of fiction on the whole, where it does get to something that is true, right? It gets to something that is deeper, it exists on a different level, it, you know, allows us to see the world in a completely different way that we may not be able to quite understand just in a, from a more historical document, let's say. This is what I'm using for lack of a better term.
Right.
And I think that that's what this book kind of illustrates well. And it's part of what makes it so challenging as well.
Yeah, I'm totally in agreement there. But we've been on this point for a while. Let's go over to talking about Victor, Ludmilla, and a little bit about Nadia. But before we get there, maybe this is a good time for a break.
Yeah, I think so. We'll be back in a few seconds.
A few seconds, about 30 to 40. This episode was brought to you by you, our listeners. You can support independent podcasting by heading to our website, slaviclitpod.com. You'll get access to the notes we used to make this episode, including links to all the secondary sources mentioned.
Sorry, just your tone, everything. There was...
every time I get there and I forget there's not another sentence.
If you want to support the show, but you don't want to spend any of your hard-earned rubles, you can join our email list for free at slaviclitpod.com, or you can leave us a very nice review wherever you get your podcasts, but I especially like reading them on Apple Podcasts. And I do read them. I stalk them.
Matt reads every single one, so make sure they're nice.
Otherwise, I'll cry.
Questions, comments, want to appear on our Office Hours podcasts? Drop us a line. You can reach our voicemail at 209-800-3944, or you can also email us a voice recording or text question at slaviclitpod@gmail.com. We'll bring your questions onto the podcast and do our best to address it.
All right, back to the gross man.
All right, so let's talk about Moscow. we've been joking a lot about... I've been talking a lot about how Victor's opinion of the state ebbs and flows with his own career, which is to me a lot of what this section is about. Plus, also, in speaking of the way characters die, a lot of other characters start to disappear. Not like they're like disappeared, but they're kind of disappearing from public life. They're retiring. They're being asked to step aside. All these sort of things. Not like a purge per se, but. Public life is
different. No, it's not
now.
Like a purge per se. They're yeah, just a systematic retiring of senior officials.
Yeah, it's like a purge in a traditional. Yeah, it's like not the, when you say purge, you have a certain imagination in the Soviet context. This one is, no one's being shot and but you know, we're not having people being shot in the Lubyanka floor yet.
that's
comes
for the
later.
Early 50s, baby.
Right. Is there anywhere here that you'd like to begin?
I wanted to begin by again reiterating my claim to fame that these science chapters are the Grossman analog to the Tolstoy farming chapters in Anna Karenina. And I wanted to expand on that thought here a little bit, because in Anna Karenina, the farming chapters are this exploration, I think, into Tolstoy's idea of freedom. And there are a lot of scenes where Levin tries to impose Western farming methods on the peasants who don't want them. They, and Tolstoy, trust me, he knows what they want. They, only he understands what they want. I think there's a deep irony to the Tolstoyan-ness of his writing. But that's, I'm already getting on a separate tangent. So these farming chapters, they explore that sort of essence of freedom in what is a large portion of Russian employment, I would say, I guess at that time. Employment's a little loose for what it right. was. I mean, they're serfs. They're not really employed. And still, I think Tolstoy sees this as an outlet to explore sort of this individual uniqueness of what it means to be Russian or what it means to be part of this specific community at the specific time, and how that sort of a certain one-size-fits-all approach is not going to work, and it actually constricts the freedom of the peasants. Now, there is a lot that you can critique on Tolstoy, and this is just my personal particular reading of this, and I do think that for Grossman, these science chapters, it does the same function, it serves the same function, illustrates a certain role of what it's like to have this outside force kind of constrict what was a working approach, an interesting approach, something new coming to the scientific community from Victor, and he has this huge breakthrough, and he's just upset that nobody's talking about it. Instead, everyone's really concerned with the central committee member or the person that's working for the central committee member that comes to the meeting. And he's upset that these people are being pushed out of the scientific administration, even though nobody really seems to be coming after him. He seems to take it very, very personally, which is a classic Victor thing. What are you going to do? That's Victor. And so again, I'd say that this is a sort of analogous function to farming, to Tolstoy's farming. Grossman gives us Soviet science, and they are sort of technical in a way that I think the average reader might not quite understand. I think that it's fairly understandable, but not like, you know, not everyone's a scientist in the same way that not everyone's a farmer and knows everything or anything about agriculture. But similar to how we were talking about spiritual truths, there's something under the surface that is being illustrated. There's some broader point, and I think that this broader point has to do with freedom, because my idea is just that everything in this book comes back to Grossman's idea of freedom and how certain power structures either restrict or, well, no, they basically only restrict. There's very few situations in which they don't restrict. So this is why I think that there are actually so many chapters dedicated to the sort of niche and seemingly unimportant aspect of, like, who is in what committee position on the, like, science department. It doesn't seem like it should take up as much space or more space than people in House 6-1, right? And yet it does. After all this all of these war scenes, Grossman brings us right back to, like, bureaucratic committee meetings, and it's quite interesting, and I think that that's why, that is my, that's my explanation for this part, at least.
Yeah, definitely. And continuing along with the idea of freedom, I think it also goes to kind of elaborate on, you might, because if we understand kind of the state as being sort of inherently repressive towards freedom, you might ask, well, how would anyone ever put up with this? Wouldn't everyone always be a little aware of that? And, you know, of course not. But how do you depict that? And I think that does get depicted quite well in the home front situations, because the home front is strange, but we can understand the home front as the normal position of society, right? That warfare is bringing out a lot of extremes. It brings out a lot of things that aren't typical. And so what we're doing when we're following the scientists is we have all these replacements that are happening, right? We have Chapizhin stepping down, you know, Sokolov kind of disappears from scientific life. And, well, they're all more concerned with the fact that their menu in the canteen isn't quite as good as it used to be. And the ones who get scientists who get the best, right, like stuff, they're the most envied, and like, well, why do they get that? And one of the scientists at one point remarks, Sevastyanov remarked that in all probability, these parcels had stirred more passions than Copernicus. You know, of course, there's the scene where Lyudmila and Victor argue over eggs, and, you know, why don't we get more eggs? And Victor says, well, as you're aware, there are different classes of scientists. Very great, great, famous, talented, and finally, very old. Since the very great and great are no longer with us, they don't need eggs. The others receive varying quantities of eggs, semolina, and cabbage according to their rank. But then everyone gets confused by other questions. Are you active in society? Do you give seminars in Marxism? Are you close to the directors? And it comes out quite crazy. The man in charge of the Academy garage gets the same as Zelensky. 25 eggs. And so, right, when what we're realizing as we're going through this chapter is that essentially these bigger questions of freedom in extreme circumstances like warfare, and people realize that the they're completely outside the apparatus of the state, as in House 6-1, they start to kind of realize their own, you know, selfness, right? They understand their own soul, whereas in typical society, people are concerned with everyday things, with getting food, with their rations, with their grief over the war. Right. And these are the things that mutatis mutandis still concern us today. Right. Have always concerned people. And it doesn't just have to be like how much we're getting. It could be really like when it comes down to it, the ration issue is not so much an issue of, well, I need more food, but it's an issue of I would like more prestige, which is a fairly universal idea, I think.
Yeah. Just Victor, I think it's so interesting that Grossman spends this time to continue to illustrate how petty really most people's concerns are, and that we're all kind of hypocrites in this way, that we will spend time, you know, me above all else, right? We spend time reading these books, talking about these large-scale issues, but yet at the end of the day, our concerns are really just eggs. Like, you know, we all do this in one way or another. Even if we like to think that we're above it, there is still part of us, and that, well, there is the practical level of, like, I don't, you know, for a lot of people, like, I don't have enough food. I need, you know, food to feed family, kids, whatever. That's not what this is. Victor is very well off comparatively. And I think that a lot of these chapters are spent with him honing in on these issues that are really not issues, right? Like the eggs, when most of the people, like, they have, like, people, like, bringing up their enormous amounts of luggage, saying, like, you have all this apartment is for one family? Like, people, literally, multiple people come up and they can't believe how big their apartment is. And Victor's sitting there, right, going, I would rather have one more egg than Sokolov so everybody knows that I'm a better scientist than him. Right. And it's just, there's a certain level of irony and humor, and if that's your type of humor, it is mine. So I always find it a joy to read Victor, a joy and a little touch of depression, yeah, to read Victor.
Like, it's just his characterization of someone who is so smart, wise in a lot of ways, and just so stupid. It brings, I mean, I get it. You know, I like to think I know a fair bit, and also I'm incredibly dumb in many ways. So I think we could all. We could all maybe take a lesson from Grossman portraying himself as a guy who works hard and knows a lot, but man, does he overlook a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
That's a self-image we could all probably use a little bit of. But anywho, I think that's all really that sticks out to me in this section in retrospect.
Yes.
I don't know if there's any more you want to cover, or do you want to move on to talking about Liss and Eichmann?
Yeah, so I wanted to, in the essence of time, because we're going to be at about a double episode if I don't reel myself in, I wanted to sort of connect these last two large parts of this section. And I think one of the benefits of the long episodes is that we can ask a different question than the short episodes. In the short episodes, we can really get into nitty-gritty analysis, word choices, really finicky and picky issues that I have with the text. But here on these long episodes, we can kind of ask the question of why and how. And these two, I guess they call them like sequences of Liss and Eichmann going through, and they're creating the plan for the final solution, where Eichmann describes to Liss how they're going to exterminate millions of Jews, and Liss is even surprised, like, how, like, millions, like, that's a way higher number than he was expecting. And we go through these kind of, they're harrowing in their own way, the way that the construction of the gas chambers is described, the way that they're sitting down for a toast, you know, in the gas chambers. And there's a different way that these chapters are written. They're very cold, they're very sterile. There's a, you know, a chapter where Liss is going through and inspecting and describing, and it's not really described what exactly is going to be happening where he's looking, you know, like in these gas chambers. And every thing that he uses is this cold bureaucratic language. I think there's a point where he describes their test as like laboratory experiments, when what they're talking about is experimenting with different ways to mass murder Jews. And so there's a, like a really careful and cautious selection of word choice in a few of those chapters that I found extremely, extremely well written. And it gives a very, very interesting perspective and sort of counterpart to Eichmann in Jerusalem and the idea of, or Arendt's idea of banality of evil. And it was very, very interesting. But then when you compare that sequence to Sophie Leventon and David and the many other people that Grossman then depicts being killed in the gas chambers, it's much, much, much different. It could not be described as cold or sterile. Instead, as Sophia is holding the dead David in her arms, she describes herself as finally becoming a mother. And instead, you have this extreme tenderness in the face of certain death and in the face of certain death of millions of Jews. And it is a really, this to me was, I mean, probably the hardest scene to read in the whole book. So this is every time when our Discord users would say like, oh, this is a tough chapter, I'm like, oh, you just wait. Oh, you just wait.
It's only going to get tougher.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. There are some other pretty brutal scenes, but that one is especially brutal. And I think it's worth noting, of course, that this is quite a long sequence. I mean, it takes almost, I think, 5 to 10 chapters. Like, there's a lot. There's a very slow and anxious and uneasy building up of kind of the way that the Jews who are about to be killed, the way that they're kind of, slowly coming to terms with what's happening. And it's extremely profoundly sad to read. And I think that it's just, you know, when you compare, again, how it's written to when you compare how the Liss and Eichmann scenes are written, it just, I mean, the absolute evil that permeates that is just, it becomes even more profound. And I just really appreciate, you know, this section of the book, basically.
Yeah, I think it kind of, the book, that section kind of implicitly rejects the idea that you can do evil dispassionately.
Yeah.
Because it takes on the affectation of dispassionate, right?
Mm-hmm.
They are, the Eichmann and Liss sit down in the gas chamber and they have a nice meal of sandwiches and wine. But it's like, Eichmann is sort of this wolfish character who's unbothered by this, but Liss, who is an SS officer, I mean, you know, of course, this is Grossman's depiction, but this is how Grossman is choosing to depict it, is described as his heart is so full as that it's about to burst. Like, this is so full of tension. It's just below the surface, because The tension itself, like that emotion is not a necessary one. It's in fact actively hindering their progress towards what they want. And as the chapter points out, life in a national socialist state couldn't just be allowed to develop freely. Every step had to be directed and to control and organize factories and armies, reading circles, people's summer holidays, their maternal feelings, how they breathe and sing. To control all this, you need leaders. Life no longer has the right to grow freely like grass, to rise and fall like the sea. And when Grossman talks about the state like repressing freedom, he's not talking in this kind of traditional sense, like, oh, well, I, you know, like, whatever, talk to like some big 2A kind of person, you know, like, the government's going to take away my guns. That's not what Grossman's talking about. He's talking about the right of, or the freedom to just kind of, to let your soul develop in whatever direction it will. If it's not useful towards the state, it has to be cut off. Right, the books you read, the places you go to holiday, the feelings you have for your own child, and in this case, the feeling of I think horror that Liss is very heavily implied to have about what they're doing is not necessary and actively hindering the process, so it's cut off. But of course, it's right there below the surface all the same. And, you know, Eichmann is depicted as a particularly repulsive character. So these are not just like normal people going into this. These are people who have things that are, as the text tells us, have things that are deeply wrong with them in one way or another.
Yeah, and I like that point that you made about how it's really not possible to do this dispassionately. I think it's a really interesting question on how they try to.
They care to give the idea, or, you know, because it's more effective, it's more efficient to do this dispassionately.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, I think that's something that I found really interesting in this whole process. At no point does Grossman ever try to engage with the why. I think that's really uninteresting, or maybe is not relevant to him. It doesn't matter why. They're not sitting down and saying, well, here's what the Jews are doing, here's why we need to do this. It's just, okay, it needs to happen. Is there a reason? If there is one, to Grossman, it's not important to portray. And maybe for these characters to apply, it doesn't matter to them either. Merely, it's what the state has decreed, and therefore, it's what we're going to do. Which is like such an evil point of view, right? Like,
yeah.
The idea that, you know, entire people could be unnecessary, or people could be illegal.
I think that's fair, though, that he doesn't really get into the why. In the sense that, right, you know, there's really no theoretical, there's no strong theoretical basis for this. But he does touch the issue of nationality and how this gets warped. And so there is some discussion on it, but on the real, like, why did they try to exterminate, like, every Jew that they, in the territories that they controlled? Of course, like, you know, there's no, it shouldn't need saying, but really there's no theoretical, there's no ounce of legitimate theoretical basis for this. And so... where Grossman excels, I think, is just kind of getting into that, the mindset of the type of person that would do that. And I think that's what remains especially resonant, is identifying those certain tendencies that might be nudged or pushed with certain rhetoric that, you know, and it sounds really like, I don't know. Sometimes it, you know, like when you're on Twitter, you know, people, you know, will point out certain rhetoric, and it, you know, it's not the most thoughtful in the way it can be pointed out, and I think that can be damaging to certain causes, and so I think that sometimes we might even have a tendency to like sort of over point out certain things, but it, you know, it's still it's a challenge, I would say.
No, I completely agree. I think Grossman's right not to touch on it, because I think he's deemed it unimportant, and it is, because there is no logic that could justify this, and there's no reason to even entertain debating it. Don't entertain debating it. Just be like Grossman and discard it. And then he gets at maybe what I think he sees, and I would agree with him, is the real core of the issue. You know, when these characters are not even thinking about it, he's thinking about what are the levers and the mechanisms that can make people do these things, kind of as you said, right? Like, that's what's important to Grossman, and I think he's correct in disregarding the why in favor of how.
Mm-hmm.
Because the how is perpetually relevant.
It's perpetually relevant, and it's like the more interesting question, I think. It's the more complicated question. And so I don't know. I think that's the enduring question, really.
Yeah, which is, I think, why this is such a great novel. It does ask those enduring questions. I do think it's interesting when the moment, not that this is the end of the book, but that this climax brings to the end a very certain a certain plot line, you know, in Life and Fate. Others will continue on. But when I was reading it, I couldn't help but think of the end of Stalingrad and this idea of motherhood and how there's so many themes in Stalingrad as a much more acceptable book have been so radically subverted in Life and Fate. And this is, I don't know if this is meant to be there, but this is such an interesting one where we have the idea of becoming a mother as a positive thing in both these cases, right? In the end of Stalingrad, you have Vera telling your father, like, you know, I'm going to be a mother and I think I want to keep it. And then he's like, okay, sure. Okay. If you know, we'll figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you want to do. And it's this sort of like, okay, you know, there is a reason to keep bringing kids into this world, because if she didn't want to bring this kid in the world, she could have it aborted. Like, it's not worth bringing a kid in this world. And that's a fair, very fair choice. Very fair choice at any point in time, especially at that point in the war. Very fair choice. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not worth bringing a kid into this world. But in this case here, we have specifically in the moment of death, not at any other point. It's the moment when David dies that she thinks that I've become a mother. And that's such a, I think that I was really struggling with that for a long time. Like, why motherhood in this particular moment of all moments? And I'll be completely honest. I didn't come up with this answer myself. I completely incidentally, I was looking like a couple chapters before, I was doing research for a post, and I was like, I kind of made an offhand line, like, oh, it'll be, you know, it won't be the celestial judges, and if they're judged by people, it won't matter until after the war. Then I kind of thought, oh, is this character, this SF officer, is he a real person? Was he actually, can I actually mention what actually happened to him? And I don't think he is, but when I looked it up, I happened to find a review of Life and Fate written by William T. Vollman, which is hilarious because William T. Vollman is one of my favorite authors of all time. And I was like, that's so funny that he's written a review of Life and Fate. And so I'm lifting this point pretty much wholesale from his article or his review of it, which is called Art and Politics. And I'm just going to summarize it here. But he calls, you know, naturally connects Life and Fate and War and Peace. And he says the interesting thing about Life and Fate is that it does not have any of the depth of Tolstoy's characters. But that's not a knock against the novel, because these characters don't live in a time that would allow that. They are very literally subject to the whims of fate that decides their lives for the most part, because this era does not allow for the kind of, and he doesn't use it, but I think in the terms we've been talking about, doesn't allow for the freedom of other eras, right? And this is something that actually I think is kind of even remarked upon in Life and Fate when Sophia Levantin is going to the gas chamber. She, I don't have the exact line written down here, but she thinks of Jesus and Tolstoy, right? Where she's like kind of walking in and she's like, oh, thinks about the ideas. She thinks a foolish young Jew and an old Russian pupil, being Jesus and Tolstoy, of his once preached the doctrine of nonviolence, she thought, but that was before fascism. these are concepts for another time. But the fact that they are not full people is not a knock against it. And he ends the chapter saying this, Grossman offers no prescription for enduring suffering. Probably because there isn't one. He suggests that people who are brave enough or loving enough can bear their fate more easily. Of course, when you're in the gas chamber, it doesn't matter whether you endure or you scream. Either way, in 20 minutes, you'll be dead. But to you, it matters. Describing the death agony of two Jews, Grossman tells us how a woman clasped the boy with the peculiar strength familiar to the Germans who work there. When they emptied the chamber, they never attempted to separate bodies locked in a close embrace. It is Grossman's genius to convince us that that strength is enough. And I agree with Vollman in this case. I think in this, the idea of becoming a mother, it's not necessarily specifically like, oh, you know, it's good for you know, like, it's like, I don't think Grossman's putting forth like women should have this particular feeling. This idea of a child bring adult such comfort is not, this is not the first time this has appeared in Grossman's work. I think it also happens in The Old Teacher, which is that case, a young boy and an older man and an older teacher. And what happens here is, even though in both cases both sets of these people are set to die, it's meaningless in a sense, but also it's an assertion of their essential humanity that they can still, even in this moment, choose to love and open their hearts to someone like that, and think of David, you know, as a son in that final moment, in that this moment which will now be forever. This is where she makes her final stand, in a sense, hugging the slight bird-like body close to her body, so close that presumably when the guards take them out, they will not be able to pry their bodies apart. And it's not much, but it's what humanity has in such a wolfish era. And I think that is a kind of inspiring in the darkest possible sense.
Yeah, I think that the idea of motherhood in Stalingrad, it still kind of continues this sort of like optimistic material linear trajectory, and that, you know, the future is bright because we've produced offspring that are going to continue to move us forward, push us forward. And there is a line here where Sophia realizes there is no future. She only has a past. And I think that to sort of assert any sense of humanity, you know, freedom in the loose sense of the word here, at a time like this, is extraordinary. And I think that's what Grossman's capturing, and I would agree with Volman in the sense that just, you know, there is really no, like, prescription for this that will make anybody feel good after reading it. And I think even though we can point to a, I consider it like a bleak optimism, I think that even though we can point to it, it's still not going to be satisfying. I don't know that you can read this and say, yep, that's enough for me, awesome, close the cover, put it back on the shelf, and feel good about it. Time I finish Life and Fate, I feel like I need to not read anything else for like a month. I need to just sit and feel kind of bad.
I think it's maybe one of the greatest novels of its generation, maybe of its entire century, by its virtue of the fact that it's in many ways it doesn't succeed in so many things you traditionally would think of in literature, for characterization, for all these other things.
I don't agree with him on that personally. I don't think the characters are not as deep.
I think I do, but I think that's intentional, because it's like, this is not a time for that. They don't get to explore their souls as deeply.
Well, you know who else doesn't get to explore their souls very deeply is literally all the peasants in Tolstoy. You know, you get like a handful of aristocrats, so I really don't, like, I don't buy this personally.
That's a fair point. That's a
you
fair
get
point.
Rich yeah, Grossman really does cosplaying as peasants. That's what you get. And you that's can call a, it depth, but whatever.
Yeah, Grossman, I guess, does fully live when Tolstoy's like, we don't have a true history of people because we don't ever think about the history of peasants.
Yeah, we're like,
Grossman's like, yeah, so I'm going to write a book about those people, I guess. You could have done that too, but...
Yeah.
All right, yeah, that's a fair
I see what he's getting at. There's a constraint that exists that's not present in Tolstoy. But I don't know that I'd phrase it like that. Like old
yeah.
Vully.
All right, yeah.
Willie T. Vully.
Yeah, but I think that is why it is. In spite of you could point to so many shortcomings, like easily one of the greatest books I've ever read, and probably absolutely the most provocative book I've ever read.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't call them shortcomings. I'd call them deliberate features.
All right, yeah, that's a good way to phrase it.
Yeah, Life and Fate is the, you know, like the Stalingrad patch notes that we needed. It's not a bug, it's a feature all along.
Okay. I think maybe this is, we've gone a little long, and now that we're going to video game metaphors, maybe this is a good time to start thinking about wrapping it up, unless there's anything else you wanted to cover.
We gotta go.
We gotta go before Matt starts going in deeper cuts. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, before we completely wrap up, I gotta ask you, what are we covering in our next episode?
Next episode, be sure to bring your student ID so you can get into the office, because we're going to be doing office hours, baby.
I like that we still have the bit of the script. If you're reading along with us, be sure to pick up your copy. Pick up your copy of the syllabus on your way in.
Yeah.
What's the syllabus? I don't know. Bring it in. We'll figure it out with you.
Nobody reads the syllabus. I could save so much time if everyone read the syllabus, but you don't. You don't. So read the syllabus for next week.
Yeah, I used to think that was odd when I was in college. Like, you don't read the syllabus?
Oh, and I used to love reading the syllabi before going to class.
Yeah, it's important.
You got all the info you need right there.
It's because I planned to slack off really hard in every class I was ever in, so I really need to know all the dates for the actually important stuff.
It's very tactical. I like knowing anything, because anything that exists outside of my knowledge is against my consent.
Matt knows how to get to my heart, which is Cormac McCarthy. Well, the thing is that I thought that was odd until I realized how many of my peers also, like, when it came time to, like, because in Davis, you know, we didn't have student housing, really. You had to figure it out yourself after your freshman year, for the most part. If you even during your freshman year, you didn't have to live in housing. How many people I knew who'd never read their leases before signing them?
Awesome.
And then later on to get unpleasant surprises because of that.
Awesome.
Which was a surprising amount. And then everything else clicked into place, that this is just how life is.
Awesome. And how their fate is.
And other fate. It did, yeah, that life did determine their fate in a particular sense. But
There's nothing to read for next week, but if you want to read something else we've covered on the podcast, chances are we have a nice little affiliate link on our website. You can pick up your books there. It helps us get a few bucks and you get a book. So isn't that nice?
I know. Wins all around.
To help keep our show independent and for exclusive access to notes containing all the research that went into this episode, head on over to our website, slaviclitpod.com. Before we let you go, we want to extend a sincere thank you to all of our current supporters.
Camille, Emma, Lauren, Erica, Michelle, Juliana, Diane, Oleg, John, Timex, Melissa, Baron, Aldo, Ben, Gabe, George, Claire, Amy, Allie, Soraya, Jackson, Molly, Emma, Mike, Marianne, Mickey, Eric, Reagan, Mike, Peter, Eric, Ben, Claire, Jeff, Inez, Mai, Robert, Joseph, Daniel, Lou, Nina, Gary, Janice, Mary, Anne, Isaac, Emily, Amanda, Caitlin, Yitza, Irini, and Pakrab. The music used in this episode was Stara Kino by Peremotka. You can find more of their stuff on Bandcamp or Spotify. The links and spelling are in the show notes.
You'll hear from us again soon.